invitation to speak here. So I just want to tell you my thoughts on where the black hole story is. So when black hole thermodynamics was first discovered in the 1970s, people found black holes to be very puzzling. For one thing, the entropy seemed to be given by the surface area of the black hole, but there was nothing to see in the black hole. It all looked like empty space because of the no-hair theorems. So what is this entropy counting? And then in Hawking's discovery of Hawking radiation, the black hole radiated radiated its energy by the production of entangled pairs, and this leads to the black hole information paradox, which I'll review shortly a couple of slides down. It is often said in these days that black holes continue to be mysterious, and we don't quite understand the answers to these questions. But I think that is not so. I think we actually do understand black holes well, and we do understand what has happened to these puzzles from the past, at least if your theory is string theory, which I'll be assuming for this talk. So let's just begin with reviewing what the information puzzle is for those who might not be very familiar with it. So if you burn a piece of coal, and that's in some initial state I call psi I, you can just sit down with pen and paper and compute what state it would go to, knowing the equations of quantum electrodynamics, and that will be some state psi final, and so the coal disappears, and you're left with the radiation. Because that's a definite state that you can, in principle, even compute with pen and paper, a definite state, you can now check this fact by taking a machine which checks the question, are you in the state psi f? And just by the rules of quantum mechanics, the answer to that question will be yes. You can make another instance of this, and the answer again will be yes, as many times as you want to do that. But that's not quite the case when a black hole evaporates away, at least by Hawking's process, because in that process, you produce a pair of entangled quanta. The outside one is sometimes called B, and the inside one is called C. And the fact that they are entangled can be modeled in this by taking this very simple state. It doesn't matter for the paradox how you model it. But for example, if these are both in the state 0, and or you can add to that both of them being in the state 1, you can see the state is entangled. So then as the hole keeps radiating, the entanglement of the radiation with whatever left behind actually keeps rising. And that's what this graph is supposed to show. And then you see the problem after some time. The entire puzzle can then be framed as follows. So again, we'll make the black hole by, let's say, taking two particles. Let's say you go to the LHC, you collide two particles hard, and you make a black hole. So you know the initial state of the stuff, and then you make this black hole. But when this radiates away, it's going to leave you with radiation. And then let's say the black hole is gone, and you're left with radiation. But now this is an entangled state, so it's not just some particular state of the radiation. It is different states, psi I of the radiation, entangled with states chi I, which were what are in the black hole. But now there is no black hole. So now you have a state of radiation on which if you try to do a measurement with this machine, whatever state you try to make this machine check for, you can never get a unique answer. So you know, you can't make any state which if you apply to that radiation will say, aha, this is your state. If there, for example, if there were 10 terms in this sum, then sometimes you'll get this one answer, sometimes you'll get that answer. And so this radiation is in an entangled state, and usually there's nothing wrong with being in an entangled state as long as there's something else in the universe that you're entangled with. So the overall state makes sense. But now that the black hole is gone, this radiation is the only thing left, and it doesn't have a unique state, and that's a violation of quantum mechanics, and that's the black hole information paradox of this person, Stephen Hawking, whose face you well know. Okay, so this Hawking's original argument was around for a while, and people did a lot of things to try to get around it. They couldn't really find any hole in the argument, and in fact, now we can make it into a rigorous statement by using some inequalities that were developed over the years. And the final statement, put in colloquial terms, reads the following. Suppose you assume, and as you go through these, you might think, you know, check in your mind as to which of these all of these might look reasonable to you. If the exact quantum gravity theory is unitary, I suppose people usually would like to have that. And then normal laboratory physics should hold as you go further and further away from the black hole. It should hold to a better and better approximation. So that just means there's no like secret tunnels which go into the black hole and just come out and dump information out to you near infinity, because then you'd be sitting in this room and suddenly somebody comes and dumps information on you. You won't have local physics. So if you don't have that, if you're far from the black hole, just normal lab physics, And you also require the radiation is in a pure state. That's the one we had before that comes out just like from a piece of coal. If you measure it, it has a definite state, you get a unique answer. If you want all these things, then there cannot be any low-energy semi-classical approximation which describes the black hole. So sometimes people have been fond of saying the actual black hole might be very complicated, but we could extract from that a simple semi-classical, what they call code subspace, in which you actually see semi-classical physics. So maybe black holes can be thought of for low-energy physics in terms of the way we think about physics in this room, and it's not possible. So this is the rigorous form of Hawking's argument. There is actually no way to get around it. Something has to go. And that shouldn't be very surprising. If you had a puzzle holding there for so many years, there couldn't possibly be any simple way of maintaining your picture of the black hole and also solving the puzzle. And these things just say that, in fact, just can't do it. So the key point in these theorems was the following. For a long time, there was confusion swirling around the following idea that if you take this entangled pair state, which I had just talked about, which Hawking had at, let's say, his leading order in calculation, one might wonder that if one makes small corrections to the state of each pair, maybe a, let's say a 1% correction coming from some quantum gravity effect that we don't know what it is, but there could be, in principle, any small quantum gravity effect that we don't know. And you might think a small effect, of course, shouldn't change much, but on the other hand, people knew that by the time a solar mass black hole evaporates, it'll emit about 10 to the power 77 quanta, so you have a large number of quanta. So in principle, it's legitimate to worry that even if you make a 0.1% correction to each quantum, by the time you take into account all the delicate correlation between 10 to the 77 quanta, maybe the whole state is not really entangled. Maybe you were just confused about it. So maybe Hawking did a leading order calculation, but with so many particles involved, how do you know the subleading effects don't actually overwhelm you? And so that's the power of these theorems, that if you use some theorems from quantum information theory, if you use the machinery of these, you can actually prove that that's not the case. If the entanglement at step n is called Sn, then at the next step of emission, the entanglement will go up by whatever Hawking said, which is log 2, because you get one more particle pair which is entangled. But if the correction here was at a norm epsilon, and now you can entangle this in any way you like with things in whatever you're doing, then you will have at most a minus 2 epsilon. So if the leading order Hawking answer went like this, with all corrections, it'll have to keep going. It can't actually come down and actually get you what's called the page curve of a normal body. It can't behave like a piece of coal. So in other words, what we have is that any small correction to low energy dynamics around the horizon, it cannot resolve the information paradox. You need an order unity correction. So now the question becomes, how are we going to go and get such a correction? Because after all, for a long time, we have believed that black holes have no hair. And the reason for that is also intuitively clear. Black hole collapse is a runaway process. When something becomes close to the size of the horizon, the inward pull on it actually goes towards infinity. So everything gets sucked in. And once it goes inside the horizon, light cones point in and just sends you in. So we always thought that black holes clean out and leave you all the mass in the center. But if you do that, you actually cannot save unitarity. So this is the puzzle. It's now completely rigorous. And we got to see what's the way around it. OK, so what does string theory tell us about black holes? So in string theory, how do you make a black hole? So this is a theory which is very nice in the sense it has no free parameters. We've been hearing that in the philosophy talks also. That's a good thing. It has no free parameters, completely rigid. And so it has definite rules. You also can't add any particles or take them away. It has some strings and brains with definite interactions. That's all you have. That's what you have to use. So if you have to make a black hole, you'd be making it by taking the bound states of the objects in the theory. And there are graviton, there are strings, there are brains, and so on. So typically, you would compactify some dimensions. String theory lives in 9 plus 1 dimensions, but you can compactify them. The first black holes which were made in string theory with success had 4 plus 1 non-compact dimensions, so 4 plus 1 Minkowski space, not 3 plus 1, but very soon thereafter, 3 plus 1 black holes were also done. And some of the people who did that are sitting in this room. You can see that. So Rob Myers did some very nice work on that. And you can compactify the other dimensions. So you can make the other dimensions into a circle and a torus, a circle, and another four-dimensional manifold called K3. K3 looks confusing. It's not a three-dimensional manifold. It's a four-dimensional manifold. Anyway, you can compactify some dimensions. And now you're down to 4 plus 1 non-compact dimensions. And the ones you've compactified now, for example, if you have a circle, you can imagine wrapping a string on it. Or you can wrap a string, or you can wrap what's called a D1 brain. It's just like a string. And if you wrap something on a compact dimension, then from the point of view of what you see in the non-compact dimensions, it just looks like a point mass sitting there. So if you wrap a lot of string somewhere, then you would see, put a lot of mass in one place, and that's how you try to make a black hole. It turns out that to make a black hole, you can't just put a lot of one kind of object. Just taking a lot of one brains of strings doesn't make a good black hole. You should mix together two or three different kinds of objects. And so the different things you could take are, I wrote down these one brains you could take, and one of them, you could take five brains, which you could wrap on T4 cross S1, that makes a five-dimensional manifold. You could wrap five brains on it, you could take N5 of those. You can also just take a graviton running around this compact circle, and again, from the point of view of the non-compact dimensions, it looks like a point mass, it has some energy. So you could do that as well. We call it momentum modes denoted as P, and you could take NP units of that. Well, making a bound sheet of these concentrates some mass in one place, and that's the only way to make a black hole in the theory. So the simplest black hole that you could make is what's called a two-charge extremal hole. It's also called a small black hole. And there you can see I have my compact dimension. On that, I have wrapped this N1 brain. I have wrapped it multiple times so it becomes a heavy object to make like a black hole, not just one brain. So you can see me wrapping it many times around. Let's say N1 times I have wrapped it around, and I have put NP units of these momentum-carrying gravitons running along it, and that's denoted by this arrow over here. So this is a black hole. It carries what's called winding charge, because the strings are also charged. A string going this way is opposite to a string going that way. So I'll get charged black holes when I do this. And same with the momentum charge, because a graviton going this way is opposite to a graviton going that way. So I'll get black holes carrying charges, but I've also got mass in there. And it turns out what I'll end up making is an extremal black hole with mass equals charge in the appropriate units. Well, at weak coupling, this is just a vibrating string, because if you have a string wrapped like this, and you add to it some gravitons which are going to carry momentum, when you make a bound state of the gravitons in the string, the bound state is very simple. Actually, everything in string theory is very simple. So if you make a bound state of strings, it just becomes a string which is multi-wound and then joined back on itself. If you want to add some gravitons carrying momentum to it, they simply become traveling waves which make the string vibrate, and there they carry the momentum. So everything is very intuitive, and so we know exactly what it is. And you can then compute the entropy, which just means if I give you a given amount of winding and a given amount of momentum, I can ask you how many states I can get of that kind. And you can see where the states would come from. You can distribute the momentum along the string in different harmonics. You can put all in the lowest harmonic, or some in this harmonic, some in that harmonic. You just count all the possibilities, and that's what these people did in the early days. And you find that the entropy you get by taking the log of the number of states is proportional to the N1 times NP. So you get expressions like this. And this is the first cases where people manage to get an entropy which is sort of large. Its proportion is growing with the number of charges. If you just take one kind of brain, there is actually no entropy. It doesn't grow with the number of charges. But once you mix two kinds of brains, you can see how the entropy is going, and how one is getting it is also completely transparent. Well, this was all at weak coupling, because you can see what the strings are doing at weak coupling. It's just a vibrating string, so it's very easy to count what you want to count. But if you go to strong coupling now, you would expect that you get a black hole. So once you have a lot of mass and the coupling is strong enough, and the coupling in string theory is a free parameter, but then it also controls, because it's a unified theory, it also controls Newton's constant. So if you make Newton's constant very small, then you can't get a black hole, because really, so the black hole is G times M over C squared. So as you increase the coupling and don't have a free string, you expect all this mass will basically make a black hole around it. So then what you could do is you could make a black hole with the same charges and mass that you got from these strings, and then you could try to see if for that guy I could compute the Bekenstein entropy. It turns out that at the this black hole is somehow what's called a small black hole. So at the horizon of this black hole, the higher derivative terms in string theory are also important. So instead of the Bekenstein entropy, you end up using what's called the Bekenstein-Wald entropy. And that has a A by 4G, which you are familiar with from the Bekenstein calculation, but also another A by 4G from the higher derivative terms that come in. So in this particular case, it becomes A by 2G. In any case, it turns out that when you actually compute it, at least for this case done over here, it turns out that the entropy which you get from the calculation of the gravity solution exactly matches to the calculation you get for these strings. So this is somehow the most toy example of what we know in string theory about black holes and how we understand their entropy. You can make the black hole at weak coupling. Because supersymmetry, one has general arguments that the number of states can't change as you go from weak coupling to strong coupling. At weak coupling, the states are very easy to count. We just did that. And then at just the vibrations of a string, at strong coupling, you have something like the Bekenstein entropy, and you find an exact match. So because that was a small black hole and the higher derivative, higher curvature corrections were coming in, yes?
A quick question. So how did G come about there? Because that constant that you had up there, there was no G there, right?
Yeah, so when you measure the area, the area comes from the metric produced by this, and the metric produced by these guys is proportional to the coupling, because the metric produced is proportional to the GM over some R square in this case, because 4 plus 1 dimensional. So this is the number of brains. You multiply each brain, so you multiply N1 by the mass of each brain, which is proportional to the length of the compact dimension, times the string tension. Then you multiply it by G Newton to get the effect in the gravity. So when you're actually computing the gravitational solution and getting the area, G is all over the place. It's a very beautiful fact that when you divide by G, it's all gone. It's remarkable how many things are gone, because not only the coupling G is gone to get this number, what's also gone at the same time are the size of the compact dimensions. I had so many variables, the volume of the T4, the volume of the size of the S1. It's very beautiful that they all cancel and they give you an exact match.
So basically your argument is that you let these things source gravity.
That's right.
Metric, so G comes there, but then
the entropy anyway has a G.
Area, okay, so area then is proportional to G, you
said. Yeah, also comes out to be proportional to G. As important is the correct G. I mean, there's a G in 10 dimensions, the G in 5 dimensions is that divided by the volume of compact dimensions, but they all go in correctly to give you this answer.
If G was 0, then you say you get 0 area from this setup.
That's right. Okay, so that hole had all these higher curvature terms and so on, so people are a little uncomfortable with that being a very good black hole. But if you add one more charge in it, and you have three charges, so now I have the strings and their vibration modes and also the five brains I've stuck in there, so now I have three charges, and you can do a similar calculation, and the entropy now grows like N1, N2, N3, and this time you can, there's no higher derivative corrections, there's just a by 4g for the Bekeston entropy, and you get an exact match. So that's the famous Stromangan-Wafer result from 96, and so there you have an exact match for the entropies. People often try to extrapolate this idea to near extremal holes and also to far from extremal holes. It's amazing that if you do a slightly heuristic extrapolation using both brains and anti-brains, you actually find that the answers are exactly on the dot. So the entropy of all black holes, extremal, near extremal, far from extremal, including Schwarzschild, in four dimensions, five dimensions, those cases have all been studied, and the number comes out exactly right with every coefficient. So with all this, it seems we have a good support for the idea that at least in string theory, Bekeston entropy just counts the microstates of the black hole. So previously even that wasn't clear. It wasn't clear what the Bekeston entropy really meant, because there's nothing to see in the black hole. But with all this evidence, it looks like in string theory, we should be comfortable that it is actually counting string states. But we still have our problem. Yes, please.
This is rude to do when I just walked in.
But please do.
But I have a bone to pick about the statement you just made.
Okay, where am I?
Count this... the states of a black hole, or did you count the states of some D brains?
Okay, these were the states of D brains, and then we, at this point, we just said that because of supersymmetry, we know that the number of states can't change as we change the coupling.
Right.
So that's what we have.
Right. So
yes.
You counted the number, but not the actual states, I would say.
You mean we haven't made the states?
Because of a trick,
yeah.
You knew that if you counted this other number, then you were also counting the number of black.
Because
holes.
Of supersymmetry.
Yeah. I just want to
so far, that's where we are. That's exactly where we are. So because supersymmetry, we know that as you go to a strong coupling, the number of states can't change. It's actually an index which can't change. And then the near extremal, far extremal ones also end up working, but we don't quite know why they work. We just know that they work if you just naively extrapolate the formula. That's what I was saying on the previous slide. These extrapolations where you add brains and anti-brains, they somehow give you all the answer down to the last factor of 2 and pi. We don't completely know that because this time you can't use supersymmetry to prove it, but it works. So then I would just say that with that, there seems to be good support for the idea that at least in string theory, the Bekeston entropy is actually counting the states of a black hole. But we still have our problem with the Hawking issue, because now at the weak coupling, we had a picture of some brains and we could just see what they were. And suppose that strong coupling, we get the usual black hole where the states all just disappear into the inside their horizon. Then again, if you take the non-extremal ones which actually produce any radiation, you'd be back in the information paradox. So we haven't learned anything about that. That puzzle seems to remain. And so the question is that really the correct strong coupling picture? So way back, just after all these Stromangan-Wafer things and so on came and we started understanding deep brains very well, we did an estimate of how the size of a string-bound state actually depends on the coupling, the string coupling, and the number of brains you have in the bound state. And interestingly, it's a complicated formula. It depends on all the number of charges you have in the bound state. but it grows with the number of charges. If you pack more brains in there, normally people had, maybe you could have an intuitive idea that all the brains inside a black hole should shrink to something like Planck size or string size, something like that. But actually the size of the bound thread grows with the number of objects in there. It's a little bit more like nuclear physics, where you have hard sphere packing, so the size of a nucleus actually grows like n to the 1/3. So it grows with the number of brains. It also grows with the string coupling. These are size volume of the compact T4. This is the volume of the compact circle. And amazingly, you get a pretty complicated expression, but that expression is exactly of the same order as the radius of the black hole that you would make with these charges and at this coupling. So this is, of course, just an estimate, but this suggests that perhaps in string theory, every time you try to make a bound state, maybe you never end up making a horizon at all. And if that was the case, you'd really be out of your puzzle. Of course, as I said, this is just an estimate, so the question is, can we make this more precise? And so to do that, let's just start from the simplest state that we can.
So you hear this, call this thing a black hole, but like, imagine if it was this argument that the size of the string is the size of the horizon, if it was a neutron star or something else that wasn't a black hole, what in this argument would be different?
Let me see if I
know. How do you know this is a black hole? So if you make some construction of a string and with vacuum brains in compact dimension, and you call it a black hole, but how do I know this is a black hole and not something else?
Okay, that's a good question. So maybe let me see if I can answer it in the following way. Let's start from the other side. In string theory, if I have to make anything which could be a black hole, all I can do is take bound state for strings in different ways.
Yeah.
And all we are going to do is we're going to make bound state of strings in different ways. And every time we do that, what we want to do is to find the wave function of these guys and see if the wave function is like look like a point with vacuum around it, or the wave function has a size which is of the order of the horizon size. So it's a concrete technical question, right? If you can actually make all the bound states of objects in string theory, that's all that you have for black holes. The entropy is matching, but there is nothing else. If that's all that you can find, then that's all that you have.
Okay.
Because we have only these objects in the theory, and all we can do is make the bound states. All the rules are clear, they are fixed. So we just have to make the bound states and see what we get. Okay, so let's start with the simplest system, which is what's called the two-charge extremal black hole, and that's the one we were talking about before. We take these strings, N1 of these strings wrapped in a circle, and then we have momentum along them. And you can see how simple string theory is, because everything you do in physics 101 is all that you need to do to understand to see what we are doing here. So just imagine opening up the string. So I just opened up to its covering length, so it's called L total is N times this compact circle length. So I just opened up just to see what it looks like. And then, as I said, the momentum modes on it, I just give it a vibration profile. So there's the vibration profile. And all the different states of this small black hole are going to be different vibration profiles on the string. So this is what you learned in physics 101. You can put different vibration profiles carrying the same momentum, and there are all the states, and they give you the correct entropy. We already know that. And now here comes the point. Why did people think that the black hole was spherically symmetric? If you actually take the string and look for a spherically symmetric solution, then you would get a normal black hole. It has a horizon, it has a singularity, you get all the normal things. But if you actually look at what you have, the string has a vibration profile. And if you look at a string with a vibration profile, you find that the string is actually spread out. Every little piece here, every little piece of length L, because the compactification is L, and we just open it up over here, every little piece gives a little piece like this. So the whole thing looks like a curve going around like this in space. And you can see it has spread over a transverse area because it had to carry some momentum. Now you might say, if I don't put any momentum, the string would be straight. That's true, but in that case, the entropy also goes to zero. The entropy was N1 times NP. Okay? So I have to put the momentum, and the more momentum I put, the bigger this becomes, and the bigger this size becomes. And so you can actually compute the metric produced by this vibrating string, and that's something whose technology we know. And now, most importantly, we are going to be at strong coupling. At weak coupling, we have counted the states, but that's not the black hole. We want to be at a coupling which is strong at the value where we expected a black hole. But interestingly, we can actually compute the metric produced by a string at strong coupling. There's something known from the days of the cosmic string work. The Vachaspati transform tells you how to find the metric of a string carrying a wave if you know the metric of a string which is not carrying a wave. You don't need to see the solution, but just to tell you that you can find them explicitly, there is the metric. So for any profile of this, which is a vibration profile given by this function f, you plug that into these functions. They give you certain functions here. You plug them into the metric, and there you actually know all the states of this small black hole. So now you know the wave functions at strong coupling, not just at weak coupling. And the lessons you get from that are the following. First of all, you find none of these microstates have any horizon. You have the metrics, you can just go and check. They don't have a horizon. The surface area of the generic state, if you just draw this area where this this string was sort of going around, and just draw a ball around it to see where all these strings were confined, and you try to find the estimate the area of that, you find the radius of that is the same order as what you thought the horizon radius should be. Okay? So these things are sort of horizon-sized objects you're getting there. Importantly, as we said before, they're not spherically symmetric. If you actually impose the spherically symmetric ansatz first, and then start looking for solutions to string theory, you'd find something which has a horizon, has a singularity, it has a horizon after taking the higher curvature correction into account, and you'd get this solution. But as it turns out, this is actually not a solution of the theory. There is no way to actually put the momentum on a string and to still keep it spherically symmetric. If I gave you a string, it turns out the fundamental string has no vibration modes which are longitudinal. It only has transverse modes. So the moment you put a transverse mode, it's going to spread. The moment it spreads in a transverse direction, it's not spherically symmetric. It will break it either this way or that way. They all do different things. So here we have a simple case where we have the simplest possible black hole. We know all the states of a black hole carrying N1 and NP charges. The entropy matches exactly. There are no other states because you know all the states of the string. Supersymmetry tells you there's no other magical state which can come in over here. We know their wave functions at strong coupling, and none of them have a horizon, none of them have a singularity. Okay? So in the simplest case, we are completely done. This black hole has been studied to death in many, many duality frames, been like semi-classically quantized, everything has been done with it. And so for this particular one, we actually understand everything. And for this one, at least, we understand what we should say for different puzzles. I mean, that the puzzles get resolved because there just is no black hole. So in the years after that, in the last two decades, lots and lots of other cases have been computed where you see these green boxes. It basically is telling you that we've added a D5 brain in there. So now you have three charges. So for two charges, we could get all the states, and you have the complete set of states for the black hole. You know everything about it. Once you go to three charges, we don't know all the states. We can't make them all of them at strong coupling. Of course, at weak coupling, you can make them, play with them. But that doesn't tell you anything about the black hole. But at strong coupling, lots and lots of families have been studied. And very importantly, in each case, you find there is no horizon and no singularity. If you get even one case with a horizon, just like, then it's all over, because you could then use that one and get your information paradox back. But it's very important that in absolutely no case do you ever get a horizon. Yeah?
I think you just said in the N1, in the two-charge case, you get all the states of the black hole. You made that sentence.
Yeah, yeah.
Isn't that geometry one with zero horizon area?
So not quite. This is what I was drawing here. So that's what I was saying, that once you put the R-square corrections, it actually gets a horizon area, and that was the result of Dabolkar, Maloney, and somebody, Dabolkar, Kalvash, Maloney. It actually exactly matches the Bekenstein walled entropy. The A/4 comes from the Bekenstein part, and the higher curve, which terms give another A/4, and it gives you A/2g. So after you take into account the R-square terms, it actually had a horizon area. The Bekenstein walled entropy was A/2g, and that's an exact match to the microscopic count.
Can you slow down a little bit here? Why? I mean, so can you explain why it's to be expected that you would be able to count all the states in that particular case? By counting string states, and you can't do that in other cases.
So here there are no other states. That's very clear, right? Because if you have these charges of string winding and string momentum, okay, you go to weak coupling, and we can follow it all along. At weak coupling, string winding and string momentum means you have a string and it carries momentum. We know how to count all those states. It's just a state of a string carrying momentum. We can follow them at any value of the coupling, not just weak and strong. At any value of the coupling, we know how to actually construct the geometries. That's the solution which I was giving you here. The coupling goes into all these. We know this is the solution at any value of the coupling.
Because the two charge states have more supersymmetry or something? I'm missing a key point here. What?
So the reason you could construct it is basically at this key point, as I said, this looks like something carrying a traveling wave, right? You'll be superposing many of these strands, each sort of is carrying some wave. And because you have supersymmetry, as you probably well know from the study of cosmic strings, if you have multiple cosmic strings all carrying a wave in the same direction, you can superpose them by harmonic functions and get a solution of the total thing. If they were not all carrying a wave in the same direction, so they were not supersymmetric respect to each other, simple superposition doesn't work. So it's easier to find the solutions. In this case, you can find all the solutions explicitly, but if they were not supersymmetric, you couldn't find them that easily.
Right, so is the two-charge case more supersymmetric than the three-charge case? What's the difference? That's what I'm asking.
It does have more supersymmetry, but that's not quite the reason why the two charge could be done explicitly. The moment you add more charges, there are more states, because the entropy went as N1, N2, N3, like N1, N2 for two guys. And it turns out that you basically need to break. There's just no solution generating technique we know which can handle all three charges at the same time. I mean, that would be great to find. We just haven't found that yet. With two charges, there's a way to get in one duality frame, then you can go to all of the duality frames. This was the trick. And so there is more supersymmetry, but I don't know if that's the key. So there are fewer states. OK, so this looks like the picture that, you know, we have all these little cases for three charges. So I mean, all two charges have been studied. I put that over here. But in all these three charge cases are also known. So all the different corners of the space, all possible limits have been covered. Somebody could always say, you know, there could always be more complicated guys you haven't looked at yet, and maybe they have a horizon. But then that's why we had this small correction theorem. If you get even one state which does have a horizon, then you're finished. You cannot actually save unitarity in the theory. And okay, so I would say that if there's any state which is not a fuzzball, it wouldn't work. So having all this evidence and that theorem together suggests to me that in string theory, we have support for the idea, what we call the fuzzball paradigm, that you never actually end up getting the traditional horizon, which we now define by saying that there should be a region around the horizon where the local state, psi, is basically the vacuum up to some small corrections. Let's call that the traditional horizon. And then it would sort of give you entangled pairs up to small corrections. But we don't actually get that. The actual overlap of the state with the vacuum is basically negligible. It's nowhere near the vacuum. You don't get this at all. It just radiates from a surface like a normal body. A lot of people have contributed to this program. I just tried to write some of their names down here.
So yes. Sorry. I wonder if you had a typo in your previous slide, the one before this. You said, if not fuzzball, then cannot get non-unitary. You mean cannot get unitary?
Thank you. Thank you. Cannot get unitary.
Too many negatives.
Yes.
Triple negative.
Triple negative. Thank you. Okay, so let's see what lessons we've learned from this. Let's see if we can extract some juice out of this and see why did this happen? How did we get this solution? And why is all this thing working? So let's first ask, why in string theory are microstates as big as the horizon scale? Normally, you thought microstates would be very small. Like, now that we have the solutions, can we see why they are swelling up to the horizon scale? And the idea is actually very simple. If you just look at a harmonic oscillator, the ground state wave function is this big. The next one is bigger. The next one is bigger. And that's because they all need to be orthogonal to each other. So if the one is like this, the next one to be orthogonal has to be like spaced out compared to it, right? So that's why they get bigger and bigger. And if you look at the solutions you have, you can actually see it's basically just phase space. Previously, we never knew the solutions we were counting in the black hole. We thought they were all sitting at a point. But really, if you have explicit solutions, they all need to be orthogonal to each other to actually account for the entropy. And you just can't fit that many orthogonal solutions if you don't have that much region. And so when you look at the solutions, you find sort of like the maximally packed phase space that you can get. And so a test for that is we first look at only that subset of solutions. Since we have them all, we can look at any subset if we like, all those which could actually fit in a smaller region. Take a string which just vibrates like this, with a small amplitude, but high frequency. It carries the same momentum. There are fewer solutions like that. So you could look for all those which fit in some region, which is mu times the horizon radius with mu less than 1, let's say mu equal to a half. And then you compute the area of that. And then that, again, satisfies the Bekenstein kind of relation. So somehow, as you look at smaller areas, you can also keep less states in it. So basically, it's just like phase space. You just can't fit that many states in a small volume. As you know from your elementary physics, you can only fit one state for every h bar cube of phase space volume. There can be only one quantum state. And that's basically guiding the whole Bekenstein kind of swelling up formula. And what happened to all the no-hair arguments? So there's a detailed analysis of that by Gibbons and Warner in this nice paper. And they noticed how string theory has all these extra dimensional, extended objects, Jeon-Simmons terms. And one by one, all the no-hair arguments that people had before, you can find each one of them actually has a hole. And string theory just bypasses all of them and gets you the solution. But I'll just tell you about one of them, which I think will tell us something about how these fuzzballs actually work. There was used to be this thing called the Bucdell's theorem, which said that if you have a fluid sphere and whose radius is less than 2 1/4 m, now 2 m is the horizon radius, so 2 1/4 m is bigger than that. But if you try to make a fluid sphere which is 2 1/4 m or smaller, it'll always collapse under its own pull. And the way the proof worked was you take this fluid sphere and then you put the pressure to zero at the surface and you integrate it inside the pressure balance equation. And then you find that at some point before you reach the origin, the pressure goes to infinity. So you say pressure can't be infinite, so the whole thing has to collapse. So that's the well-known Bucdell theorem. And that's basically giving you the intuitive idea that if something is sufficiently compact, the gravitational pull is so much, it's going to suck you in and collapse the guy. But then you can look at this toy model to see what's actually happening in the fuzzball solutions. So this is just a toy model which shows you what happens in fuzzball. So take the geometry from here to here is just what is called a Euclidean short shell. If you take the short shell geometry and turn t to I tau, it looks like this. And so what that looks like is that you get something like a cigar, where this tau circle, which is the imaginary time, just comes in at the horizon. It just closes off smoothly like a cigar. And this is the angular direction. So you have this cigar and then it's all around like this. So this region is not in the space-time. You can just throw it away. The space-time actually ends at r equals 2m. This r naught is 2. And you just tag on a time here. So in 4 plus 1 dimensions, it's a complete good metric. It's a solution of Einstein's equations in 4 plus 1 gravity, the vacuum Einstein's equations. Okay. And now suppose you reduce it on the dimensional tau, on the direction tau, to get a 3 plus 1 gravity solution. And then the size of that circle gives you a scalar field. So I'll call that scalar field phi. And then if you work out a stress tensor for the scalar field, it's the normal one for a scalar field with the correct signs and everything. Nothing surprising over there. But at this point, you could ask a question which might look a little puzzling. In 3 plus 1 dimensions, in 3 plus 1 dimensions, you just have some scalar field there. It has positive energy, normally you would think. And so why isn't this scalar field just attracting itself and collapsing? How is the solution standing there? It's just like a solution of the vacuum equations. And if you actually compute a stress tensor, you find that it has, you know, the diagonal form, it has rho pressures in all the directions, and all these quantities, including the pressures, are all diverging as you get to the tip of the cigar. So Bugdal would have thrown this thing out and saying, I don't want this solution. But interestingly, it's a completely smooth solution in 5 dimensions. It's only the 3 plus 1 projection, which is bad. You can't break into 3 plus 1 and the other direction because the circle is shrinking, but the 5D solution is completely smooth. And so roughly speaking, all the fuzzballs work this way. The compact dimensions, which are normally thought to be of Planck length, we always thought they are so small, and the horizon radius is like 3 kilometers, so let's just factor them out and assume they go for a ride all the way up to the singularity, and then we start playing with 3 plus 1 dimensions, and we never found any of the hair for black holes. But the states are actually all hiding somewhere else. The compact dimensions, 5 are non-trivial over the non-compact ones, and there are lots and lots of solutions like that, and they are the ones which, at least in our two-charge case where we know all the states, they gave us all the entropy. And so different ways of twisting the compact dimensions over these end up giving us all the microstates. And that's how we, so that's where we found states which people were missing. So what's the consequence of the fuzzball structure? There's some very interesting work by a Schrödinger group here which I've been following. If you actually take low-energy electromagnetic waves, then it would actually scatter off a fuzzball. So if you take a non-extremal fuzzball now, if something had this kind of structure, is there anything you could observe? I was rather surprised by this result because I used to think it would not be possible to actually observe the scattering of waves that easily. But they did convince me that if you have a low-energy electromagnetic wave, it would actually scatter off a fuzzball. So that may actually be an observational signature. It also, I would agree for low-energy gravitational waves. I'm a little worried it may not work for high energy waves like in the nonlinear limit, where we are looking for black hole mergers, but that's something I'm actually trying to understand by reading the papers that they're doing. It's some very interesting directions here that I would just like to advertise, which is being done here at Perimeter. Okay, so I'm a little bit out of time, so maybe I'll skip the next part and just jump to my conclusions, but maybe I'll just say what's the outline of what I was going to say here. So black holes have a very well-defined thermodynamical behavior. They have an entropy, a temperature, and a radiation rate, which we know. And sometimes people ask the question that if you now find it in string theory, instead of getting black holes, you're getting these horizon-sized objects, right? They're not normal, big, messy quantum states, but they don't actually have a horizon. Would you actually end up reproducing these objects? And it turns out that for very general results, you do. Because for very general reasons, you actually end up getting the same thermodynamical behavior to leading order. But I can chat about that separately with people if they're interested. But since I'm out of time, let me just skip that and jump to the part which I would call lessons, okay? Okay, so what are the real lessons for this? Since the black hole puzzle was an important puzzle, when we resolve it, we should have some deep lessons that change the way we think about quantum gravity. And so I'd like to just try to elucidate a lesson in sort of increasing steps of detail. So at a very crude level, I would say that our grounds of units, our trouble always has been that Planck length is actually very small, and a black hole is very big, so you would think that semi-classical physics should be good, and all quantum gravity is here. But that argument is too quick, because to make a big black hole, you have to put together a large number of quanta n, and so you should really be asking, is the relevant scale of quantum gravity Planck length, or some power of n times Planck length? And what we're really finding from string theory is that the latter is true, and this kind of results and the actual constructions we have are telling us that really, it's not Planck scale. Quantum gravity can work on macroscopic scales if you put a large number of particles together. So I think that's a deep lesson. But that's very crude. Let's see if we can now see a little more detail what exactly is going on. So this is where we are at the next level of accuracy. If you go back and try to write a path integral, we all know it has a measure. Suppose you have measure over the metric and all other things in string theory, and then there's a classical action. And to get a semi-classical limit to understand the black hole, what we've always done is because there's an h bar here, we extremize the classical action, because extremizing this, because of this being very small, was the main thing to do, and we would normally ignore the measure. But the measure, roughly speaking, is telling you how many states contribute to the path integral. And in the black hole, that should be something to do with the Bekenstein entropy, because that many states, we already know without knowing what the states are, there's a Bekenstein entropy. So let's estimate these quantities. The classical action is like energy into time. The energy is like the mass of the black hole. So in d space dimensions, so d plus 1 space-time dimensions, that's what you get for the mass of the black hole. And for the time, let's also put the same scale, the radius of the horizon there. And so you find the classical action over h bar looks like the radius of the horizon upon Lp to some power. And so clearly, this is a big number. And so this is a big suppressed number. That's what we think semi-classical physics should do. That's why we try to extremize, or rather minimize, the s-classical. But then if you look at the measure term and you say it should be of the order of e to the s Bekenstein to count the number of states which are contributing, and then this is order a by g, and there you find this is actually of the same order. So even without knowing what the black hole states were, we should have been suspicious about anybody saying that the black hole is a semi-classical object, because in a black hole, the entropy is so big, much bigger than that of a normal star or anything like that, that this term actually competes with this. And so it wasn't at all obvious that we should be doing a semi-classical game here. And when we actually look at a solution in this two-charge case where we have them all at strong coupling where the black hole should exist, we really find it's the phase space doing it. You just can't pack more of those states close to each other because the phase space doesn't allow it. They have to be orthogonal. So you can just see that this is actually what really works out. Okay, so let's go to the next level of detail on this, and I won't say much about just to point out how we are trying to think about it these days. Yeah, okay. This is actually my second last slide, so I'm wrapping up. So the point is, okay, so we say all this path integral and all these states are there, but what do they actually do? What's the actual mechanism by which the semi-classical approximations violated? And the way it's violated is that the whole structure of the quantum gravity vacuum itself changes. So how does it change? We all know the vacuum can have vacuum fluctuations. It's not empty. So in this room, we always have, you know, electron-positron fluctuations. But let's ask if we could also have fluctuations of these virtual objects. We can have virtual fluctuations of objects that look more like the fuzzballs we've been talking about. Well, you might say, well, small ones might be okay of order Planck mass, but what about big ones, maybe a million times Planck mass or solar mass? Interestingly, those fluctuations are also there. And why are they there? Of course, each one of them will be highly suppressed because the probability of a very massive fluctuation is again e to the minus something, and you can estimate what that something is. But the number of fluctuations of that kind is again governed by something like the Bekenstein entropy. It's a huge phase space because there are many different kinds of fluctuations of a big size. At the moment you multiply by that, you find it's exactly a canceling power. So you can actually get fluctuations of this kind of thing of all sizes. It's more like a second order phase transition where you have virtual fluctuations of all sizes everywhere, and not just some, like what you get away from a phase transition where you have fluctuations only of little one bit here or there. And with that picture, one gets a picture of what actually happens in gravitational collapse and what goes wrong with the normal semi-classical picture. In the normal picture, you have a dust ball, it goes through its horizon, and then you know everything just goes to the singularity. But what you have with these virtual fluctuations is that they are, these fluctuations are there in the vacuum. As this guy goes inside the horizon, these virtual fluctuations actually get compressed. And because the light goes pointing inwards, they keep getting compressed. We can talk about this in detail if anybody's interested. And they are the ones that turn into on-shell fuzzballs. We sort of put together a picture of how the large entropy and large phase space actually, so now the whole idea that you actually have the equivalence principle and locally nothing can know that something is coming and so on, that's not quite true because these virtual fluctuations are extended in object, in size. And so they can actually detect the formation of a closed trap surface, and one can put together a picture, just a picture, of how all these phase space arguments are telling you how the picture of semi-classical gravitational collapse actually changes. Okay, that's my last slide then. It's just a summary, I'll just leave it up for you. But just to mention, there's some very interesting work by Robert Brandenburger and his collaborator recently on trying to apply these virtual fluctuation ideas to cosmology, because whatever we learned about black holes should be very true for cosmology, which also have a horizon, they also have a singularity, the dynamics is also very much the same. Total amount of mass inside a cosmological horizon, the same order as required to make a black hole with that horizon area. So we know the equations are all the same. So if in the for black holes, the physics got modified, jumping out from the Planck scale to horizon scale because of this, what we have learned from string theory, then something similar should come up in cosmology and might tell us how to evade things like the difficulties we are facing with the cosmological constant, inflation, and other things. And I'll be giving a talk on those things on Tuesday here, if anybody's around. Okay, thank you very much.
Thanks. Maybe one quick question,
I have lots, but I will try to ask a quick one. So basically, there are no horizons in the fuzzball paradigm. Is that correct? Like, when anything collapses, it never really becomes what we would think of a black hole, but rather this fuzzball thing.
That's absolutely correct.
So there's a fuzzball in the center of the galaxy. The event horizon telescope took the first picture of the fuzzball, and so on. Is that correct?
That's absolutely correct. So I would say in string theory, there is no way to actually make a horizon that persists over, let's say, a crossing time or so. It'll have to fill up with something by tunneling into these other states I'm mentioning and so on. Because if it does persist, I think the rigorous virtual information paradox tells you you can't sustain the theory.
Even if supersymmetry isn't right?
It doesn't have that much. The Hawking puzzle has nothing to do with supersymmetry.
So it doesn't, this is no. Supersymmetry. Earlier you said you needed Susie to do the counting.
Well, that was to actually make those particular examples of states. But the Hawking puzzle is separate, right? So if you ever get a horizon in any theory, and you have all those other things that physics far away is not connected to physics, and so, I mean, decouples. So that is nothing with Susie. That's an absolute. You can't solve the puzzle.
Great.